I try to support founders in the idea that it's good to kind of practice out the pitch and ask questions to angels. It's kind of a safe space because usually they're very sensitive to kind of reputational risk. And by having at least a conversation with them to share an idea, to share your ambition, your goal, your mission, your vision, et cetera, you can get some feedback. And it's usually a very safe space. So most angel investors are very sensitive to private information.
Tap into the minds of change makers creating real impact on people and our planet. It's time to live your purpose. I'm your host, Dale Wilkinson, and this is Good Makers. Hey, what is up? Welcome to episode 37 of Good Makers, where I interview social entrepreneurs and change makers making a real difference. If this is your first time here, I'd love for you to stick around. So hit the subscribe button and be part of the family. You can also visit goodgigs.app and join our community of purpose-driven professionals who get to access career opportunities, courses to better themselves, and a network of like-minded folks who care about people and the planet. Someone who cares about the planet is our guest on this episode, Zeka Len, who is an impact-focused angel investor who is backing some of the coolest venture-scaled social enterprises in the market. First, Zeka talks about what an angel investor is and how they can be helpful to a startup founder who is looking to take their business to the next level. He then talks about why and how he evaluates his investments in companies that are making a positive impact on the world. We also talk about what type of opportunities he is interested in and how founders can get on his radar. You're going to love this episode with the incredible Zeka Len. Zeka, how you doing? Thank you for coming onto the show. We're already laughing because we've been joking offline. So how you doing, man?
Yes, it's great. It's great to be here. I've been looking forward to being on your podcast for some time. Thank you, Dale.
I'm super excited because I'm apparently the first podcast you've been on, which really surprises me because I've been listening to you quite a bit with your podcast, but also your recent activity on Clubhouse and the community that you're building over there.
Thank you.
I'm really glad that you're on here. You are an impact angel that is investing in positive startups that are creating impact in the world.
Correct.
And we're gonna jump into that. What is angel investing and more specifically impact angel investing? But I wanted to get a bit of a backstory in terms of how you got into this space and what led you here from the career aspect.
Yes, indeed. Thank you. Yes, it's really quite a long story. I could probably fill a few episodes. Maybe part of the reason I haven't been on a lot of podcasts. It's funny. I was telling somebody earlier today, having a podcast and a club on Clubhouse for Positive with I2I in the middle, Positive. It's on venture scale positive impacts. The idea about a year ago was to unpack sort of what venture capital and positive impact look like. And it's been a journey so far. We can break into that later. But to get to your question, my background, I started my early career in my mid-20s, nearing my late 20s, in fact, as an environmental economist. And I was trained in that school. It got my start with an environmental consulting firm. There was a publicly traded company based out of New York, and they were established from a Superfund site, which is an EPA designation for a very toxic type of site. In the 1970s, it was called the Love Canal, which was an unfortunate environmental disaster, which had toxic waste from the aerospace industry. And some of these aerospace engineers that were on the negative impactful side decided to get out of the industry and start an amazing environmental consulting firm called Ecology and Environment.
Yeah.
And that experience kind of launched me into something that was very unexpected. So I guess you could say I'm open to different career paths. I went from there and got into consulting, had our own consulting firm focused on logistics and supply chain and sustainability. Then later moved to Southern California here in Huntington Beach. Now we moved down here and I started getting into startups and data science and kind of teaching myself how to be a full stack data scientist, which includes both data engineering and data science. Worked for a media and entertainment company called Iris TV. I'm still actually an advisor to them. Wonderful company, great team of people, excellent culture. And then worked for kind of family office hedge funds. And for the last couple of years, I've been kind of out on my own here, building a portfolio of impact centered or VC impact aligned companies that I invest in all across the US. And yeah, as in now leaning into becoming an emerging fund manager. It's been quite a wild journey. Happy to break out into it.
That is awesome. First of all, going back a bit, the Love Canal. Why was it called the Love Canal?
You know, it shouldn't be funny in any way. I think the story goes that it was kind of like a canal that they were dumping into, and it caught on fire or something like that. If I have the story correct, I should know the story more technically, but it was the launch of this under the kind of NEPA and hazardous environmental sites. It was, yeah, quite dramatic. I got a chance while doing that work to collaborate with a lot of environmental engineers, environmental planners, civil engineers, environmental economists, worked on a team with environmental economists, worked on all these different types of renewable energy and large-scale energy impact analyses where we would engage with multiple stakeholders. I got a chance to work on cleanup mitigation types of sites with engineering economics. Wow. To try to help increase public health, working with state agencies, et cetera. It was an eye-opener to get that opportunity right out of school, because as a graduate in a blended degree, which was environmental economics meets environmental science and studies, there are very, very few jobs that have this aspect of environmental economics. It's mm-hmm. very rare to find a job like that. So I kind of carved the job out myself. And this may be useful to some of the listeners. My father was an architect. I grew up on an island up in the Northwest, and my father passed away. He was quite unique, very inspirational person. He traveled all around the world with my mother back in the 1960s, 70s, ended up working in Japan and actually Northern Australia of all places during the cyclone in Darwin.
Yep.
They lived through that occurrence.
What was the, I should know this. What was the mm-hmm. Cyclone Tracy?
Huge one back in the early 1970s, and it was disastrous. My folks were living there at the time and traveling all through Southeast Asia and spent a few years doing so. And I grew up with a lot of these stories, and they ended up moving to this island where I'm from, San Juan Island up in the Northwest, beautiful archipelago with hundreds of islands up near Seattle area. And my father built this Japanese style home that was off the grid. It was in 1982-ish or so. And wow. It was DC powered. He was also, my father was one of the first developers in the country, to my knowledge, and especially in the Northwest, that developed a passive solar condominium complex with my uncle. It was fully solar powered, partial grid powered, but also passive solar, meaning that they could collect heat in the with seasonal variation to try to regulate heat and save energy. And this was post-Carter, late 70s, when we had the first oil boom. Carter put solar panels on the White House, and it inspired a new kind of movement towards solar in the United States. And my dad and my uncles, who were also architects, were engaged in that work very early on. So I grew up in a DC-powered home with a generator and a wood stove in the middle of the forest on an island. And that's why I really have such an inclination toward sustainability in the environment.
Have you got any pictures? Because that sounds awesome.
Yes, yes.
You're living on an island.
It's amazing.
I'd love to see that. And that was going to be my question. Like, how did you get into the environment space and working on that? But it sounds like your parents were a big influence of that.
Absolutely. Definitely. Always have to kind of recognize that for myself. It really gives me motivation. Being taught the right way as a youth, I think it helps to kind of have an inspiration for why we do things. That's not to say that I think that's the only reason to get engaged with something socially or sustainably impactful. I think that it's really useful to have that cornerstone.
Moving into impact investing that you're doing now, there could be some listeners that aren't really aware of raising money from investors for a startup or a business that they may have. So can we talk about what is an angel investor initially, and then we'll kind of get into the impact aspect of it. But what's an angel investor and how does that differ from a venture capitalist?
Great question. An angel investor is a term that doesn't have a legal definition. It can be used in different ways. Traditionally, the history of it was gentlemen in the early 20th century that would fund plays, especially I think in New York City, to what I can recall. And they were looking for talent in funding these plays. It was that aspect. Venture capital itself, as this funding of a venture, which angel investors do, it actually goes way back to Europe a couple hundred years ago or so, where there were voyages that were funded by people who would take part of the spoils when going for resources via ship overseas and things like that. The history of finance and kind of goes back that far. Angel investing, specifically in the United States at least, is usually considered to be under what the SEC considers the accredited investor standards. And these rules have been around for a long time, say 80 years, to help protect investors who may otherwise be scammed and things like this. So there's a threshold of either income or just recently designation for things like FINRA designations, et cetera. And historically also a net worth, threshold that the SEC defines. And what that allows individuals to do outside of something called Reg CF or regulation crowdfunding, it allows those individuals to invest in hedge funds, certain like equity projects, blockchain, private markets, equity, venture capital, and also other types of real estate deals and things like that. So it's usually very high risk, high speculation. There's usually a lot of knowledge that needs to go into that, either as a sophisticated investor, which is another term, or an angel investor, accredited investor.
So if you are a founder with a startup and you are looking for an angel investor, they need to be an accredited investor for them to be able to invest in your startup.
There are, for angel accredited, there are standards for that under certain, no legal advice given here or advice otherwise, but under Reg D offerings, for example, and you can do it in other ways through sophisticated standards as well. There are just different trade-offs that go along with things like that.
Gotcha. At what point in a founder's startup journey would they pitch to an angel investor versus potentially a VC firm? Are they looking at the same time? Are they going to angels initially for that kind of pre-seed round?
Yeah, in my opinion, it depends. I think it depends on kind of what the objective of the business is. Some businesses don't plan to scale toward venture capital, for example. They may be looking for a different type of angel, maybe a friend, maybe a family member, someone that can even provide some debt and things like that. Credit cards, for example. Lots of different paths to getting started. Generally speaking, an angel investor, it's better to try to engage with them earlier rather than later, especially if they have some industry experience, especially if they really get excited about who you are and what you're working on. I try to support founders in the idea that it's good to kind of practice out the pitch and ask questions to angels. It's kind of a safe space because usually they're very sensitive to kind of reputational risk. And by having at least a conversation with them to share an idea, to share your ambition, your goal, your mission, your vision, et cetera, you can get some feedback. And it's usually a very safe space. So most angel investors are very sensitive to private information.
So when you are pitching an angel versus a fund, is there, because you do have different types of angel investors, is there anything that should be kind of different in the pitch? Like when you're thinking of who your audience is, when you're pitching them as a founder, pitching to an angel, is that going to be different to pitching to a fund?
It depends. I mean, in Europe, especially, the business angel or the angel investor, to my understanding, has different standards. It depends on what country we're talking about and a lot of other factors. In the US particularly, it's always good to know your audience and to understand what their focus area is. For example, while speaking about the startup, what kind of story are you telling? How are you getting this person engaged in the idea that you're generating? in the deck itself, some people will say, oh, it's good to have, say, like a deck that has limited information so you don't bore your audience or get too technical and things like that. For me in US, in the US tech startup ecosystem, I like to see decks that are, say, 20 slides. People are laying out the problem, the solution, the focus on impact, the unit economics a little bit, sort of what is the tech, and then how big is the market, who are your competitors, and then we're off to the races kind of thing.
Gotcha. We'll get into a little more in terms of what your ideal pitch or deck looks like. Where would one find an angel investor? Like, a founder kind of knows when they're doing their research and they can come across funds, pre-seed and seed funds, but angel investors are a lot of the time individuals. Mm-hmm. Is there any best avenue to be able to find and do your research on angel investors?
Certainly. I don't know how useful this will be. I want to get to this question, but maybe I can I maybe talk a little bit? You mentioned seed, pre-seed and those things. Can I maybe lay out a little? Okay. Well, one thing with that is it for a company that's aligning themselves with venture capital, in my opinion, you're usually doing a series of rounds that have anything from friends and family rounds to an angel accelerator round to a pre-seed round to a seed round to a seed extension round to a series A to a series B, series C, series D, then maybe an IPO or maybe what's called a SPAC or other merger and acquisition. There's this sequence that is traditional to the US venture capital ecosystem. And those paths can take, usually have one track if you're going toward institutional money, be it mm-hmm. growth equity money or what's called late stage equity, things like this. And they can get pretty complicated, et cetera, but that's pretty much the basics of what we see. But more back to your question, I will give a little bit of a plug. I wrote an article on databases that are free and open source, and I'm not trying to discourage anyone from paying. One can do that, but tried to create a Medium article on impact-focused databases on Medium. Hopefully you can put that in the show notes if you can.
Yeah, definitely.
Awesome.
Definitely.
And what that does is it helps kind of find who are the types of angels, who are the types of funds, where are these communities that have a particular focus of a particular startup and how to kind of narrow down on that set to get to people. Because actually the problem isn't so much finding angels to get in touch with. One can pay for pretty inexpensive services or can get out on Twitter and have voice, can start putting on content, being on Clubhouse, et cetera, getting your voice out there, connecting with people. You can eventually start to meet some people.
Yeah.
I was just listening to Jason Calacanis today, who was doing an interview with Adeo Rossi with the Founder Institute. And Jason Calacanis wrote a book called Angel. Loved the book and definitely give a shout out to them and Founder Institute. But he was saying to Adeo, who was interviewing Jason, which is quite rare because Jason's usually interviewing others. Jason said one thing about getting into that hustle mode to find people to connect with, the angels to connect with, is you really want to kind of load the pipeline with, say, 150 angels and just kind of blast out some emails. You're going to get about 10% back. And then out of that 15 or so folks, you're going to have meetings with them. And then maybe another 10% of those, maybe three or four, are going to give you those 25K checks as kind of a startup. That is, if your startup is aligned with venture capital. It doesn't need to be. We can break out into that as well.
Got it. So on that, not all angels will necessarily want to be aligned with venture scaled startups, right? So it is about understanding who you're targeting and also knowing what track that you want to take your startup on.
Making a plan and setting a plan, in my opinion, is a big deal. I had Elizabeth Yen on the podcast who works for Hustle Fund, and we were talking mm-hmm. a bit about some of the avenues for financiers. There's an episode there. She's tremendous. I refer to her as the matriarch of venture, and she's just superb. So I would recommend people listen to that episode as well to get some ideas of what paths you may take. Now, part of the reason for starting the podcast Positive about a year ago, just finished our first season, really stoked about that, 24 episodes, woo! Excited.
Congrats.
So basically, there are these different paths, and one of the reasons I started the podcast was I wanted to try to understand, as someone who's putting in my own capital and my own money, I'm very sensitive to kind of what the founders are doing and what they intend and where they plan to go. Mm-hmm. And so that, without taking the other people's money factor into the discussion, I wanted to try to understand kind of, okay, let's say we have what could be euphemistically referred to as a lifestyle business, something that is a small business down the street. You don't have plans to make it into a franchise. You don't have plans to expand out into other cities, et cetera, et cetera. You don't have plans to create a technology solution. That could be considered a high touch, the kind of high friction business that doesn't necessarily look like venture capital backable or VC backable. However one wants to define that, I think that's a very personal thing. So I wanted to understand that. And then what I tried to explore and what I like to explore in the conversations, and not to push the conversation more toward the impact side, but to try to gauge whether or not a company looks like something that may not have its big exit, or it may not have its big path to revenue, say until another 15 years out or 10 years out, which is a little bit longer than what venture capital would look for. So some people refer to these as kind of patient capital opportunities. Think maybe healthcare, for example, that has a really long R&D cycle. There's a lot of capital upfront costs. You need private equity to kind of participate in it. And that in family offices and or foundations. Some of them are more philanthropic. Some of them are more, it's referred to as philanthropic capital effectively. So for me, I'm aligned with the VC impact side and trying to really create vernacular and create a community and create a voice to try to tie together angel investors and VCs that are aligned with positive impacts or venture scale positive impacts. So that's the focus of the show, venture scale positive impacts.
Segueing into that and talking about your thesis when it comes to investing, was that a no-brainer for you when you did get into this space that it had to have that impact component?
It's a no-brainer because I'll say in an episode with David Gallipo, he works with Muhammad Yunus and he runs SDGX in Thailand and he worked for the United Nations. And in an episode with him, he mentioned that impact is personal. And it really resonated with me when he said that. And it inspired me along with my friend Tommy Leap. He also inspired me. He works in climate tech, a fellow investor, to think about, I was a little skeptical, is it the right time to bring the SDG, Sustainable Development Goals, into venture? And I was quite skeptical about it, but I did have a background. I'm certified in the Global Reporting Initiative, GRI, UN standards, which is used for corporate social responsibility and multi-stakeholder engagements. I'm certified in that. But I thought, why am I making excuses for this? I'm already investing in impactful, positive impact aligned companies. Yeah. Why don't I just put this into the framework of the SDG? So what I actually did is I spent about 50 hours, and it was after I interviewed David. And there's a Medium article I'll share with you as well. If you could put that in the show notes, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah.
I spent 50 hours, and basically what I did was I sorted through about 15,000 companies in about 150 verticals. And like I said, I'm kind of a geek, former data scientist background, so I used some tools to do a lot of stuff. And then I found companies that had verticals and very clear kind of mission signals, we'll call it, that aligned with venture scale. And that meant anything post Series A close, like we talked about Series A. And then they had an M&A or an IPO in the last 10 years. And I found there were 200 companies in the US that were in this arena. Okay. And then I squeezed all of them down into the SDGs and partitioned each of them out into what I refer to as social tech and sustainable tech. And within each of the SDGs, there were roughly 5-10 companies, barring things like climate tech has not scaled yet. Ocean tech has not scaled yet. Some parts of land, the land SDG goal has not scaled yet per se, but there are a lot of amazing enviro tech and other types of technologies such as blue tech, such as sustainable agriculture. We can break out on all that stuff that is going to be massive, and things like age tech as well, and other humanity-based or human rights-centered opportunities that deal with poverty, deal with water, et cetera, et cetera. So I put this landscape together and realized that actually this SDG aspect is already alive and here in this country. We're just not actually looking at it under that framework. So what the SDGs do is it's a goal set that helps us kind of look at where we want to go. And it says, can we fit into this framework? And that's really like for me now at this point, every and through the last 2 years, every single company I've invested in has either a social impact and sustainable impact category and multiple categories per investment. And that's, to me, is that's an additive to value.
So the SDGs, that there's 17 goals.
That's correct.
So you use that as your framework when looking at investment opportunities.
Correct.
So is there, within those 17 goals and those different sectors, is there any specific sectors that you're kind of more interested in? Or?
Yes. I mean, it really goes back to venture style companies that are low friction, that are scalable, low marginal costs, that you can scale out indefinitely, that are defensible. So I want to be clear that also in this VC impact lens is what's traditionally referred to as finance first impact. And that is just to say that the impact component in this very small set is you could think of it like a like an impact moat almost, where it's integral to the community, the brand, the DNA of these companies, the mission, the story of it's integral to the individuals who believe in it and the customers and the people who founded it, et cetera. Now, that's not to say that people shouldn't and can't and won't gear themselves toward impact when it's further down the line. It's just more difficult. Maybe you see a lot of publicly traded companies that become B Corps. There are a few of them. And they, I'm sure that they really want to do that internally and they see value to doing that. And I would never try to discourage it. So I'm not necessarily selecting for those who don't have the opportunity to add value that way. But I more so try to align with founders early stage that have a very strong impact focus.
Got it. Is there any type of business model that you would not invest in? So like,
I can tell you right now, machine guns, not going to do that. what this category is called technically is it's called a vice category. And if you take alcohol, tobacco, pornography, crypto, esports, it depends on who you're asking, but there are probably 10 categories that are kind of no categories.
Well, like, right.
No, yeah. The no, vice class. Like, we just don't want to invest in bullets and machine guns. I mean, all well and good for national security, et cetera, but I don't personally want to do that.
Right. There's other people that will happily do that, but not Zeka.
not today, at least. We'll see. Maybe my mindset will shift. One never knows.
Within the impact space, when you're looking at these kind of models that you touched on it there, where you, later down the stage, a founder could be like, oh, I'm going to add in this buy one, give one type model.
One matching. Tom Shoes, for example.
Right. Is that something that you steer away from? Is that something that you would still look at those kind of models?
That would definitely not fall into a no category for me. I think that it is tremendous what Tom Shoes was able to stimulate and do. There were a lot of copycats after the fact. And tacking on these types of CSR efforts can be authentic, and it oftentimes really is. But it's not so much about authenticity from the standpoint of what a venture capitalist is looking for. It's more so about how sustaining is this? What does this additively bring to the revenue generating potential of this company? And does it help it get it to exit? And not only that, and this is back to what I just kind of alluded to before, not only that, there are different terms for this people have thrown around. I like to give shout outs to people, but I can't recall the first and last name, so I want to be careful. I don't want to use other people's ideas. But there are, one of your guests, actually, Peter Bruce Clark, was on your show. He's awesome. And one of his partners at the fund, her name is Sarah Cohn, and she had a really great statement a long time ago that said basically, and I really liked it. She said that if you have a company that has, let's say, like a Tom Shoes model, and this company gets acquired and it's let's say you take it out and you're just an evil person, you take out the shoe matching aspect and the company's still generating a profit, then that is not an impact company. Now, I don't know if I agree with that. I thought it was kind of interesting to put in that in perspective, but yeah, just putting that forward.
No, I remember Peter, he was judging on a pitch night that we did for social enterprises. And that was, he mentioned that that's how they evaluate, which is super cool, which makes it kind of clear for, you know, a founder as they could be at that early stage and still kind of working out that business model.
Yes. And to the impact first side, the ones that are more sensitive to these things, impact sensitive side, we'll call it. Don't mean it in like a personal way, but for those that are very signal sensitive, we'll say, there are companies that tend to kind of like structure themselves to avoid falling into these types of outcome traps. I guess I'm making up that term too. It's like an outcome trap. We've talked about it as impact, slippage, things like this. It's very complicated and they're in, you know, we don't know, like today's, we'll just put it this way. Today's Kleenex company can look like tomorrow's Tesla. We don't know per se. There's no one that really knows that, and it's complicated.
So when a founder is pitching their startup, their opportunity, their idea to you, going back to what you mentioned earlier, where you are happy to receive a 20 slide deck.
Always.
Is that because of the impact angle and you would like to better understand the issue at hand that they're trying to solve?
I'll tell you this. What for me is most important as an angel investor, very early stage, is to really understand the person and kind of why they're doing it and where they think the problem is. And like any good business, you want to solve a problem because if your customers, if they need that solved, you're in that business. And so I actually take a little bit of a broader scope on what positive impact means. I think socially responsible business, positive impact geared businesses, SRI, ESG, all these things, ethical business, they all fall under this umbrella of just good business. You know, the idea of sustainable business is something, maybe sometimes it gets clouded by the words, but in effect, what I really am trying to advocate personally is to have customer love and care and to understand your customer and really serve your customer. That old fashioned thing, like actually serving the customer. pretty crazy. But in addition to that, once you have that as part of your offering, I think there are a lot of positive impacts that can be made. For example, interviewed someone just a while back. He's a venture capitalist. His name is Nick Cooney on the podcast. A tremendous show about the alternative protein space and clean meat space. And I was a little skeptical about that because there are aspects of GMO and other health considerations that go into fermented meats and biologically enhanced meats, et cetera. He was a co-founder of a research think tank for 20 years. He's like 20 years vegan. Just amazing person, and was very helpful in understanding some of the metrics behind things like land use, carbon impact, negative carbon impacts, water impacts, all these attributes. If you were to just go today and buy the stock of one of these companies, regardless of the technicalities around potential health risk, obviously, you would effectively be creating a positive impact by stimulating this business. And if that business is doing what it's meant to do, solve a problem for people, turns out about 90% of people are actually buying clean meats or alternative proteins, not because they love animals, but actually because they want to do it for health reasons, lowering their LDLs and things such like that. It truly doesn't matter to what their reasons are per se. And the goal isn't necessarily to change your customer, but it's to align something that creates a positive impact with something that has statistical rigor, such as this aspect of the positive environmental attributes of clean meats.
I'd love to actually get your opinion on this with mission-driven, which is another term that is used quite a bit. And most recently, well, late last year when Coinbase said...
about politics.
Yeah, said the apolitical, really kind of banning any activism in the workplace. And the essay that they put out was, we are a mission-driven company, multiple times stating that and going back to, you know, what they are doing with their company. That kind of threw me off a little. Being so diehard that we are a mission-driven company, yet we're not going to get involved in any of these major social issues that are happening, and we're not going to allow our employees to be able to do that in the workplace. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't mean to level up the discussion to something more contentious. The short answer is that I don't know. However, what I would probably point to is, which may be kind of skirting the question, but for me, yeah, I actually got my entry into economics by accident, by learning about what was called the negative income tax, which is now very closely associated to what is called the Universal Basic Income, or UBI. That idea stems back from the 1950s from an individual whose name is Milton Friedman, who was a monetary economist and a very good human being, someone that I've deeply admired for their work. They were also a very strong, independent thinker. And when his ideas were brought into the marketplace, they were very disruptive. And the aspect of Milton Friedman, which relates to the discussion that we're kind of leaning into, is in regards to what is the fundamental reason and purpose for a business. And we could debate that ad nauseum. And I believe that that will always be an evolving discussion about how much should a business be acting like a government or not. And to say it should be one way or the other would probably, I'd get a lot of hate mail or something, I guess. What Milton did was he said that business's core value function was to have independence and create a system that could become an economic engine that was empowered in support by a limited government, so to speak. Now, I'm not a conservative person. That's pretty obvious. But those ideas, he had ideas about social responsibility in business. And if you listen to the actual technicalities of how he explained it, it is very different than how it's often interpreted. You know, business in itself can be subsidized by government, and it can be an additive economic driver, just like law, things like this. Now, the freedoms that Milton was very, very strongly opinionated about, that individuals' empowerment, freedom and empowerment, was almost harking to what he was discussing regarding businesses, where founders have rights as majority shareholders. And the shareholder primacy aspect is hotly debated. For example, in a case just like what you're talking about, the triple bottom line approach may be to include stakeholders who are not aligning with value drivers of the company outside of the organization. To what level a founder or the interests that have control over a company make those decisions is not up for me to say. And I'm sure the law is evolving. There are some activities that are in regards to staking founders' rewards, like, for example, their salaries, to things like having racial and ethnic diversity or gender diversity in organizations. And as these companies get bigger and the founders lose their initial control, and let's say you have debt holders, you have boards from venture-owned companies or institutions, oftentimes the conversation will and does change more to how is the organization supporting itself through these extra financial measures in a way that drives value, back to mission-driven type of value. Mm-hmm. And it may look something like something that may cross over what Milton's line looked like in terms of these companies getting somewhat political. Now, I don't advocate that in any way. I don't necessarily know if Milton was right, et cetera, but I definitely want to highlight that from a historical context.
When it comes to the startups that you get involved with, is that something that you look at, what their employer base is made up of?
Yes and no. Again, it's always a consideration, but it's not a core decision driver per se. I personally, we're being recorded right now, and I love that you're asking this question. I personally believe that cognitive, racial, gender, ability, diversity in all forms and shapes from a multi-stakeholder angle is a value driver of a company. I'll say that out loud. I'll say it three times if I have to. Having collaboration that is diverse and having inclusiveness and a loving environment that's caring and wonderful is and value-centered from the standpoint of how does this drive toward customer value? How does this drive toward environmental value, organizational value, and other forms of externalization is always an incredibly powerful way to do business, in my opinion.
Yeah, and should really be the norm.
I hope so. And one of the problems too here, well, like I don't want to take and I don't want to pick on any organization or any individual, but in a case like a company that's starting to scale and let's say go toward IPO, et cetera, and the founder still has primary control, and they have 1,000 decisions that they're making on a daily basis that are ultra critical for everyone's well-being and success. I almost kind of wonder sometimes, how fair is it to put all of the pressure on these early stage founders, the ones that aren't nearing like massive scale with a whole bunch of advisors and boards, et cetera. How fair is it really to load these individuals up on with more burden of decision-making that's more complex? And mm-hmm. That's not to say I'm not seeking out those that are more sophisticated and complex, that are able to manage complexity and balance their own internal affairs and their own external affairs. That's whom I'm seeking. But I do also guard these founders, I guess.
Right. And why hiring is so important, and the team that you build around you as well, to have that support network and to be able to lean on them on these difficult issues. If you invest in a startup and an opportunity, you mentioned it earlier, going the VC route. What specifically does that look like? What's an ideal scenario for you for what's to happen with that startup, that company within the next 5-10 years?
Yeah, I think the product is important. Jason Calacanis, he's really an excellent thinker, and people refer to him as the GOAT, the greatest of all time, as an angel investor. He's has tremendous exits, and he's a scout for Sequoia. He has his own fund, etc. I take a lot of learnings from him as an individual, but then adapt my own always. I think from my perspective now, when it comes to an impact-oriented company, you want those traditional aspects, which is to say a large market that's defensible in terms of what the product is and the brand. And you want all these elements of timing in terms of like who you're competing against, knowing your competitor, knowing your customer, all these aspects. You want the right founding team that understands why they're doing it, back to the impact component. But sometimes there are some cases, and again, I'll highlight Jason Calacanis did in a podcast with a company called Grove Collaborative, who is nearing, he referred to them as a soonicorn, which is really fun, soon to be a unicorn. Mm-hmm. They were the first B Corp certified company to scale and be B Corp certified so far. Now, some public companies, to my understanding, got B Corp certification after the fact, and that's different. But the thing that's, in that interview with him and the founder of Grove Collaborative, which I found fascinating, was that this wasn't necessarily discussed, but to me, it was kind of a very important thing to take note of. And I call this the impact moat. For me, there's a strong component of what impact is in terms of a value sense. And actually, I listened to your first episode and I took a note. You said 23% pay cut experience. And I remember the study with this A-B test that was done, where they sent out fake resumes and try to figure out willingness to accept salaries, et cetera. Yeah. And there is also a premium, and in the US they've done studies, a premium of roughly 10, a weighted average premium of about 20% on all sustainable goods that people are willing to pay roughly 20% more for those goods. Yes.
Yep. I'm one of those people.
We all are. Yes. Yeah. And there are companies who take advantage of this and all the rest.
Yeah.
And obviously a venture scale company isn't just by default a consumer packaged good company that creates, in the case of Grove Collaborative, a non-hazardous direct-to-consumer experience that has delivered non-hazardous goods to your home where you can do cleaning. The thing I was trying to drive at here, and why I'm tying this back into circles, is that given that premium, we know people are going to be more attracted to sustainable goods overall. Mm-hmm. But the brilliance of Grove Collaborative, in my opinion, and why it makes the timing exceptional, it's not the B Corp status, in my opinion. What it is there is you're competing against the Tides, the Clorox bleaches, all these other brand names that have been there since 1922 or whatever, Bon Ami or whatever. And they're, yes, you've had your non-hazardous spray that you can get in Walmart, et cetera, et cetera. But what they've done is they've created kind of like a consumer experience that says, just make this easy. We're going to send this to you. You get a refillable bottle. It's non-hazardous. It's safe. It works. Here's the instructions and here's the community. And they have taken advantage of something disrupted. I think they will and do disrupt an industry that is fragmented to the degree of it's kind of like a feature rather than an actual like distribution platform almost. And they're going to disintermediate these types of companies. And I think we're going to see a lot of companies similar to this. This is what gets me very excited.
And that was actually going to be my next question is that, you know, if we're looking at those SDGs, is there categories, whether it's social tech, sustainable tech, is there categories that you're super excited about?
Oh my gosh, where do we start? I should be rattling off my portfolio right now.
Maybe top three. Top three categories.
That's really not very kind of you. I'll try.
Okay. And also like to frame it for the would-be social entrepreneurs that are looking to, they want to start something and are there particular areas, opportunities that they should maybe be exploring?
Yeah, I would like to pay homage here and really suggest that we need more science in technology and we need more people that have a technical understanding of things. However, even more important than that, we need people that are science-driven, diverse thinkers, diverse by life in all factors that, that understand what a business may need and how to kind of market it and drive it forward, some business experience, and that care about the impact. And that means, you know, the planet, the people. And yes, we all do care about the impact in the planet. I can give you examples of that. We all really do. I use the example of one of my professors mentioned the blue whale and how existence value, if you are to pull the average person on the street, how much would you be willing to pay every year to protect the species, the blue whale, the biggest whale on the planet? Pretty much every individual will give $5 to protect this species. So we really all do care about positive social impact and we care about sustainable positive impact. The thing is, though, that caring isn't enough and it's really about capture. And it's about being comfortably aggressive in some regard, especially for venture capital. So for me, I use this term break shit responsibly. It's it's a little bit of a play on like, you know, what Facebook may have become or will become or what was becoming. But it's also about finding more mature founders who understand the rigors, that the nuances of things like technical investing or the things about consumer demands that are quite complicated from a psychological component or from an environmental component or a social brand risk component. All of these aspects are important. And I believe that having people with cognitively, educationally diverse and life experience diverse backgrounds are going to be those individuals that are going to propel amazing new opportunities in the marketplace because they are tricky to navigate. And so to go back to your question, for example, I'm just going to rattle off a few that are really getting me excited right now. There's one called Aether, A-E-T-H-E-R. Ryan is the CEO of this company, and I really like Ryan, his background, et cetera. What they're doing is they're making a carbon negative diamond, which is a sustainable diamond effectively. And it's a consumer market, consumer good that will offset bad emissions through the form of engagement rings, things like that. Another one is Blockable, who is up in Seattle, and they have a really fascinating kind of like hybrid, low affordable housing and modular sustainable home systems that can utilize complicated factors from both like a regulatory incentive basis for the affordable housing side, but then they can also couple with other traditional developers and scaling out amazing like multifamily housing systems effectively. It's amazing. Another one, just kind of going down the list here. Well, I like this one. I'm going to give you two more. One is called Remove, and the CEO, Lewis, is just exceptional, incredible business mind. And that company, what they're doing is they're effectively kind of disintermediating two different kind of verticals. One is the sort of 1-800-GOT-JUNK type of vertical, and the other one is a Goodwill where you donate goods. They use AI to help businesses and individuals to take quick picks of their goods, their owned items, and then they quickly use kind of this whole subsystem to monetize in an efficient manner to get all your things you need to get rid of or want to get rid of done in a way to kind of empower the consumer, and that's really awesome, I believe. And then the last one is, I'll actually give a shout out here, Sheets and Giggles. It's just really fun and super positive. And what they do is they use lyocell eucalyptus, mitigating and reducing impacts regarding water use and other land use factors in offering a really fun, well-branded, well-marketed, well-distributed product that is scaling. And also they have sheets, pillows. Then I'll give another shout out. I mean, with the community-led and community-driven folks with ComStore and Lolita Taub, for example, Mac with ComStore, and just this movement toward community, I believe, it overlaps with social tech as well. Because there are, like I said, you know, if you look at the Elon Musks of the world and you look at Tesla and you look at Kleenex companies, we don't know. And there are different paths to enter into a marketplace that can capture customer love in different ways. And I believe mm-hmm. that this is the thing I'm trying to inspire.
This is very cool. And you're doing it with your own community and your own podcast.
Oh, thank you.
And so, Zach, I could personally keep on talking to you all.
Well, I hope
all
I get another invite because I like to talk, I guess.
Yeah. Where can folks find you to, A, whether they just want to listen to your podcast or join your community on Clubhouse,
yes,
or potentially, you know, want to eventually pitch to you? But, you know, you did mention earlier in the podcast that you like to have a relationship first. So where is the best place for them to?
Always start with good humor. So you've succeeded yourself, and thank you for having me on your show. It's great to be on the other side of the microphone for the first time. I really appreciate that. Generally speaking, I'd say, you know, I'd actually ask founders to do something before they touch base with me, and really put this back toward Adam Grant's book, Give and Take, fantastic book. I would say pay it forward as much as you can. Not mm-hmm. to give your business away, not to give your time away, et cetera, but really try to find opportunities to help other founders and get on people's podcasts, help podcast hosts, help the ecosystem in general, do the, you know, tech stars, give first type of thing. Pay it forward as much as you can. And you're going to find that really resonates. I'm speaking to your listeners right now, your community directly. Paying it forward is a powerful mechanism, and really, so do that, but also you can reach out to me. You can, you know, ping me on Twitter, ZECCA_LEHN, Zecca Len, and my DMs are online. Also, LinkedIn is always good. Ping me there. The podcast is on all the big platforms, Positives on you know, all the rest, all those platforms.
This has been so much fun. I appreciate you so much. Thank you for coming on.
What a pleasure. Thank you so much.
It is so awesome that we have people like Zecca actively supporting and funding entrepreneurs who are dedicated to making positive impacts. He is a wealth of knowledge and a terrific community builder as well. I personally love following him and hearing his insights. So if you want to learn more from Zecca, make sure to check out the show notes. We have links to the articles that Zecca mentioned in the episode, as well as where to find his podcast, his room on Clubhouse, and his profile on Twitter. Thank you for joining us on this episode. I'd love to hear your thoughts on what resonated with you. So pop over to goodgigs.app and join the community where we can chat about all things social impact. I look forward to seeing you there. Until next week, thanks for showing up and being you.